Welcome to our paranormal afterlife. This is our paranormal afterlife, and I'm your host, Simon Bowen. This week I'm talking to Louisa Peck about her book, Die Hard Atheist, From NDE Denier to Full-On Woo-Woo, Against My Will. Louisa had a near-death experience after having an overdose in a Manhattan nightclub. And you can enjoy the extended version of this episode ad-free, along with over 100 hours of extended episodes on Patreon. Hi, Louisa. Thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Simon.
So we're going to be talking about your book. It's called Die Hard Atheist, From NDE Denier to Full-On Woo-Woo, Against My Will. You say die hard atheist, so just how much of an atheist were you?
I was so committed to being an atheist and so committed to materialism. First of all, my father had been force-fed Catholicism, and he had had a huge resentment against religion that he started inculcating me with that resentment before I can even remember. But I do remember being very young and him explaining that religion was a crutch for people who were afraid of living and could not explain natural phenomenon. So I looked down on it from the beginning, and the older I got, the more I substantiated his view. I studied philosophy, and I would write these big, long-winded papers about how there was no God. And I was also an alcoholic, as you know. And a kind of an alcoholic creed is, you know, screw it, nothing matters. And that was my view of life.
You had this near-death experience. Before we talk about what happened with your near-death experience, was it that afterwards, and for a few years, you kind of, not dismissed it, but kind of ignored it and carried on as an atheist?
Yes. So I had this moment the day following the near-death experience when I realized I had to decide, was this real or was this a hallucination? And you can know things deep down in your heart, know that it was real, but I just could not accept it. I knew deep down that the experience had been real because I had never experienced anything like that. But if it were real, it followed to me logically that I would have to change my entire life. You look at how loath people are to change their politics. Think how loath I was to change my entire view of life. I just was like, can't do that. So it must have been a hallucination. It must have been a brain shutting down phenomenon. It was not any of it real. So I went on like that. I went on for a few years with nothing happening, but then I was in darkness, and what I mean by darkness is that with that worldview and my alcoholism, I was not happy. And so my first couple of spiritual experiences were also not happy.
You were quite young when you had your near-death experience. Was it 21 or 22?
I was 22, actually. It was 1982, and I was 22. I was born in 1960, so I was, and I didn't have any spiritual wisdom. My parents really had just taught me, beat everyone else, be the smartest, and alcohol is good. Those were my marching orders.
You were 22, and you were just out going to clubs and partying and enjoying yourself, and that's what you wanted to do at that age. But then you went to that club and you had your near-death experience.
I had moved to New York City because I wanted to be where the action was. I had just graduated from Vassar College, which is a college in the U.S. It's called one of the Seven Sisters, and it's got a very high reputation. And I had gotten Phi Beta Kappa, which is a prize kind of, and I had gotten general honors and departmental honors, and I, you know, gone out with this big bang, and then I didn't know what came next. So for me, it was, I'm going to move to New York City and I'm going to live the cool life. So morally at the time of my NDE, I was kind of manipulating boyfriends like they were chess pieces, and I had broken up with the real boyfriend so I could get with the secret boyfriend who had broken up with me because he didn't like being secret. But meanwhile, I went out with his best friend and I was contemplating starting something with him. So I had no morals. I was not a good person. At that time, I was extremely selfish and cynical and vain. And so the guy I had invited to go out with me, I had invited because he dealt cocaine. We did all his cocaine. We ran out. We bought some in the club and were told it was good stuff. But when we snorted it, it did nothing. And I later found out because it was lidocaine, not cocaine. It numbed our gums. So we bought it, but it numbed them because that's what lidocaine does. So I, at a certain point, began to experience bradycardia, which is when your heart is slowing down. I was not afraid. I did not know I was going to die, but I couldn't get any air. I felt like there was no air in the club because my heart was going slower and slower. So my brain wasn't getting oxygen. And I had a tunnel vision getting narrower and narrower. It began to seem like the club was simply dark and airless. And I was upset. My date took me to the bartender who gave me a glass of water that I did not want. And when I took that sip of water, that's when I left my body. So my body went into a grand mal seizure and cardiac arrest that lasted for 3 minutes. The bartender jumped out and did CPR for 3 minutes. Meanwhile, it seemed to me that I was rocketed up into a clear blue sky with all the air and freedom and light I could possibly want. And I did a swan dive into the ocean below me that was pure and blue and stretched from horizon to horizon. And I came to the surface and I could see the land. And the way things happen in near-death experiences, this is not a physical experience. Everything is a symbol, though I didn't know that. All I knew was that I wanted to be at the land, which was quite a ways off. And next thing I knew, I was wading onto the beach. And I didn't question anything like that. I was just like, that's good. And I saw down the beach, I saw a mesa, sort of a sea stack where the ocean had carved away everything except this old blue house. And as soon as I saw the old blue house, I got excited because I understood that it had to do with me. And next thing I know, I'm at the foot of the mesa, but it's now a bunch of rock and it's covered with grotesque, putrid slime. And I thought, is this rotten seaweed? But I also had a determination. It's not going to stop me. So I climbed it. Next thing I knew, I was at the door sill, but I had lost my body. Again, I thought, this is very inconvenient. All I was a point of subjective experience about an inch from the door sill. And I just thought, this is not going to stop me. As soon as I crossed the door sill, just that point of subjective vision moving forward. As soon as I crossed over, I knew this was the house of my ancestors. I was very close range with the floor, so I could see that the floorboards were super old and they were worn almost to powder. And I kind of like, I mean, not powder, but I don't know, there's something velvety that happens to wood if it gets worn enough. And I knew this had been crossed by all my ancestors, everyone back to the beginning of, I didn't think about it, but I just knew we all crossed and now it's my turn. And I was excited and I began to feel my ancestors all around me. So I felt them as a group being really excited that I was going to join them, but especially I felt my paternal grandfather who died before I was born. I never got to meet him. I had only known him as a picture, black and white photo with my grandmother in my father's closet because my mom didn't like them out in the house. And I can just tell you, some people care about their ancestors. Some people really love their grandparents and wish they knew their great grandparents. And I did not give a rat's ass. I did not care about anything to do with these people when I was a 22-year-old twerp. On the other side, my spirit was just rejoicing, just so excited to be joining them. So I didn't bring the baggage of my personality with me. What I brought was excitement, wonder, and a can-do kind of determination to experience what was here. I did not bring any memory of being Louisa. I left that when I first left my body. I remember thinking, thank goodness that nonsense is over with, because it was not good. And then there was supposed to be a chair in the room where my ancestors all loved to look at the sunset. And I felt gypped because the chair was not there. And I was really low to the floor and I could see the window. They all looked out, but I was like, how? I want to see the ocean and the sunset. I want to see these things. And as soon as I felt that, as soon as I chose that, then something took over. And it was, I now know, the same angel that I'm dealing with every day now. But at that point, I didn't know he existed. He pulled me by my sternum across that floor. And I felt like, whoa, what's going on? But I was delighted. I was not scared. We went up. And I remember when we went over the windowsill, I was so jazzed. I was so excited. And then we went swooping out. And I didn't know I was a we then. I thought it was just me, though I knew something else was making stuff happen. I was flying over the ocean, right above the path that the sunset left across the water. Beautiful colors in the sky all around me. And most of all, that feeling of zoom, that feeling of just moving forward so fast. And even though I didn't have a body, I had a sense of like rushing through space. This is also a hallmark of NDEs. This was kind of equivalent to my tunnel, but I didn't know any of that then. It's 1982. I've never heard of an NDE. Anyway, I'm not Louisa. I'm my spirit. So I had a thought. This is a little bit too perfect. You know, this could be a dream. Is this real? And as soon as I asked the question, is this real? A very powerful presence resonated through me with the answer. And it said, more real than anything back there. And I understood that back there did refer to my lifetime, though I didn't really remember my lifetime. But I knew what it was referencing. And I was like, you're right. It is more real. How can something be more real than real? Well, think about it. We're always a tenth of a second behind reality. All we're really reacting to is stimulation of the nerve endings on the retina and the tympan, whatever you call it, in your ear. We're reacting to light waves. We're reacting to sound waves. And our brain is putting together a hologram as best it can of where we're situated so we can survive. It's very indirect in consciousness, but when you are pure spirit, it is energy and you feel it. And these things are symbolic, but they are symbolic in a real way. I was going to the sun. The sun got bigger and bigger and I began to feel like, wow, am I going to vaporize? But I had no fear. Before I say what happened, I should say that my father, atheist that he was, very science-minded guy, had told me that everything alive on Earth got its energy from the sun, that everything we eat got its energy from the sun, so therefore all my energy came from the sun, so therefore the sun was my source. And so I got close enough to see the corona on it, and then poof, I went through that, and I was inside the sun. And that's when I had arrived in the light, which is our experience of God. And I had never imagined I could feel so much love. And I felt it as a warmth. I felt it permeating my whole being, this love, this warmth, this light. And I had a feeling like, finally, because I had struggled my whole life in my weird backward way to be good enough. And I didn't know what I was even trying for, but I knew I felt like I was failing all the time and I was not lovable. And so once I was in the light, I finally had all the love I could possibly want. And I began to sense that I was being held like an infant by a being. And I felt the being was like a very large figure sitting on the ground, but I couldn't see. All I saw was the light. And I could feel the being pouring into me. You are so loved. You are so loved. And it was me that was so loved, not just everybody. It was particular to me. And then just as inexplicably, that being said, oh, you're not done. You can't stay. Boom. The light was gone. It was just suddenly gone. And I had a frightening sensation of falling at the same time that I became consumed with rage. People will often say, what a brat you were to become consumed with rage. And I wished I could kick that being in the shins. I feel I was re-entering my body and I had to pass through this kind of outward aura or outward sheath of fear and anger that keeps us distinct from God so that we're able to have free will. It's like passing through a zone of rage and fear that we carry around with us all the time. It can be thick or it can be thin, depending on how much energy we give it. But I didn't know that. I just knew that I felt really, really mad that I tried to scream, no, and I was going to not go back. But then I felt myself falling and I was afraid and I was in darkness. But eventually I saw these little stick figures that were kind of doing antics and cartwheels and whatnot. And one of them came closer and I eventually realized he was saying, how many fingers? What is your name? And then I had this horrid, awful realization that I was back in the meat puppet, as I actually thought of it in that instant. I was back in that meat puppet. And he thought he was separate from me and he wanted me to use that stupid code that we used to use that is when you make sounds with and somehow in your throat and you shape your tongue and you like sort of burp these things out. And then the other people, it just language seemed so primitive to me. And I knew what he wanted. So I said my name and I was lying on the floor. I was surrounded by what I thought was water, but it was actually my own sweat. And they brought me outside and I was very childlike. I was about 5 years old, but this is the hardest part of my NDE to tell is that the bartender came over, squatted down where I was sitting with my date. He talked to my date for a bit and I kind of heard what they were saying. And my date had said that he had thought he should stop CPR because it just wasn't working for so long. And then he turned to me and he said, you were gone a long time. I'd say well over 3 minutes. We didn't know if you were coming back. And in my 22-year-old bratty little brain, I was already smoking a cigarette. I already had my high heels crossed. And I said, oh my God, he's got to be over 30 and he's bald and he had his mouth on my mouth. And that is so, so embarrassing. And so all I said to him was, yeah, thanks. And this is the man who gave me, he opened the door so that I could come back into my body. If he had not been there, this life would have been over. And he saved my life. And that was all I said to him. And so then, as I indicated before, it was the following morning that I reached that crossroads of, if this is real, I need to change everything. I have to basically become a different person. And all I could think of in those days, because I'd never heard of near-death experience or spirituality, I thought, I'm going to have to go to church. And I don't want to go to church. And I had this image of myself as like a churchy little, I don't know if anybody remembers the show, Patty Duke's good cousin. And I was going to be like, you know, talking to the pastor and the other Patty Duke girls. And I was just like, you know, screw that. No, I am a badass and I am going to continue to live as one. So I'm just going to put all this stuff aside and go on drinking.
One of the things I think you said in the book is that you felt that that blue house was a way station and not the destination.
Mm-hmm.
And there's one thing I've wondered about near-death experiences, if that's what they all are in some way. It's not the real afterlife. It's like a place where you go to experience the near-death experience.
I'm going to have to talk about my understanding of things, which I have gotten from the community of near-death experiencers and people whom I trust. They talk about levels of vibration. I don't know myself anything about levels of vibration, but I feel that we pass through sort of different, I can't think of Swedenborg. Doesn't he have different realms of heaven? But I feel like there were the first things that I experienced were the elements. It was air, water, earth, and then fire. But I also, in passing through, I became able to communicate with my loved ones on the other side, and specifically my relatives. So I would say that was the first stage, was this way station and this being in a spirit form so that my ancestors could let me know they were there and let me know they loved me. But then when I went over the ocean, that was like the tunnel, because many people in the tunnel feel that same sensation of moving forward. And it's when you're accelerating to a higher vibration, which is the sort of the apex of my experience, was in the sun with the angel.
So that blue house, in a way, you feel like your ancestors, when they died, that was the house that they first came to.
Yes. And when my father was dying, I had many dreams that were connected to his experience. And I didn't know he was dying on this night, but it was 2 days before he died. I dreamed I was walking down to a great big lake. And my dad was born near Lake Michigan. And the house was on the hill above me. And a woman came out from the old blue house and said, "Have you seen my little boy?" With my grandmother. I didn't really recognize her, but she had on this sort of dated gingham outfit. And she, now I know it was my grandmother. And I said, I did see him. I'm getting confused about the dream, but I guess it was just before then. I had seen a little boy being led up from the lake toward the house by a man I thought was Jamaican. And I spoke to the Jamaican man a little, and he's like, "Yes, we're going to the house." And so then when I rushed to my father later, the man taking care of him was Fijian. And I had not known that. But anyway, I would say that my father was heading to the same way station that in my imagery is an old blue house. He might experience it as a whole different place. He might experience it as Penn Station, because, you know, nothing is physical. But it was a sense of this is a place we all enter the other side through.
I was interested when you said that when you came back, you there's like, maybe it was the bartender who was asking your name and how many fingers. Mm-hmm. And you thought to yourself, he thinks we're separate. Mm-hmm. You had such a connection in the near-death experience.
Yes, because the only being I interacted with directly was my angel, but that was telepathic, and telepathic communication seemed completely normal and natural. And same as the telepathic welcomings from my ancestors. So when I was back, it kind of surprises me that I knew that this was very primitive. When people want to hear from their spirit, their loved ones who have left, they expect their loved ones to be able to communicate with them in the language of their preference, with the accent of their preference, you know, the same things we form with our vocal cords and tongue. And that's not how it works. It's knowings that we get on this side, because they can only communicate telepathically, most of them.
Yeah, I think I know what you mean. It's almost like we can transmit like an understanding very quickly. I could say two words and it would bring so much understanding. It's like if I just said Star Wars, you know what that all means, and all the films, and whether you like them or not, and who the stars were.
Yeah, and you know, I've communicated in the more recent years, in 2019 with my father, and then just last summer with my boyfriend who died. And you know, when you know someone really, really well, and they say to you something like the back door, and you say, you know, they're going to say, yeah, the back door is broken and we need to call a repair person. And I mean, you know what they were going to say. And, you know, maybe you let them say it, maybe you jump ahead. But this is how it was when I've communicated with them, that they would give me a whole thought at once. And I would just be like, received, I know, I get it. And then I would send them a whole thought and feeling at once. And I could sense that they got it.
And you kind of left Louisa behind when you went into the near-death experience.
Completely. I just felt it was the biggest bunch of nonsense.
Yeah, because in the book you sort of say Louisa was like a silly undertaking that you had done.
Yeah, I felt like, well, I tried that and it kind of didn't work, and I'm just as glad to leave it behind. That's what I thought.
So there's symbolism in your near-death experience. You kind of saw these different things that happened as symbols of something.
Mm-hmm. The sun was definitely my symbol for God. If I had seen Jesus, if I had seen any other spiritual being, it would have just scared the pants off me, right? And what we're given is what gives us the sense of joy. And for me, the sun, I did feel as is the generator of energy, and therefore the generator of life, and therefore the giver of life. And so symbolically, it was my source. So somebody else might see Jesus or whatever else they think of as their source. But that's what I was returning. I was going home.
And then there was it part of the beach, was a symbol for something? And
all I know is that that all those elements were there. And another Chinese element is wood, because the wood of the floor was also very prominent. But I feel that these elements sort of are touchstones of our reality here. And I was passing through each one toward that other realm of being.
So I wanted to talk to you about the ghost. Can you describe the ghost? What happened there?
Wow, that was out of the blue, out of the blue. So again, I'm in a very bad moral situation. I've married the secret boyfriend, but I'm in love with my coworker, the aerobics instructor, young Chinese. I was head over heels about her. And we went to overnight party at Gloucester, which is near Cape Cod, and it's very old, I mean, as old as the U.S. can be, right? We're not very old, but anyway, it's an old seaport. And I did not believe in ghosts at all, but I was jealous of her, and her boyfriend couldn't sleep, got up really early in the morning. There was a terrible storm going on, just pelting the windows. And I thought, I'm going to be King Lear and I'm going to go out and rage against fate that I don't have my girlfriend. But that's what I was like. And at this point, I'm 26 years old, maybe 27. And so I went out to rage against the elements. As soon as I went outside and the first gust of wind and rain hit me in the face, I thought, maybe this isn't such a good idea because it's tense. But I was like, no, I'm going to do it. So I went down to the ocean and I was busy raging against fate. Couldn't see anything. And then ahead of me, I don't know, about maybe 200 feet, I see this guy come out of a bog, come out of a sort of a backwater swamp, coming up over the dunes. There's no houses there. There's no nothing. And I thought, what was he bird watching? He doesn't have any binoculars. Besides, it's crazy storm. What's he up to? So I'm looking at him and I'm realizing, man, that raincoat is not nylon. That is old fashioned Macintosh. I can tell by the way it moves. He looked just like a fish sticks guy. He had on the yellow hat. He had on the yellow coat. He had on the black boots. And he was walking straight toward the water. And he was looking out as though he could see. And what he saw pained him. He was looking for something and it was not there. I didn't know that then. I knew then that he was staring at where the horizon would be if we had not been in the middle of a horrible storm, so there was no horizon. So I made up my mind, because I was, this is the era of Madonna, and I bought a lot of vintage clothes, and I just wanted to ask him, like, hey, where'd you get that really cool vintage rain gear? And I thought about him, you know, I'll say this, I'll say that. He's getting closer and closer. I'm like, no, he does not look chatty. No, he does not look like he's going to want to talk. He looks very upset. So in fact, he crossed right in front of me, and I said to him, how's it going? And I thought I saw one of his bloodshot eyes move just a little bit, and he didn't respond. So I went on another 10 steps or so, and I just thought, what a jerk. Doesn't, you know, is he too cool to say hi? And so I turned around and he was not there. And after watching for, did he throw himself in the waves? After going through every possible explanation for how he disappeared, I went back and mine were the only tracks on the beach. So I got back to the house. Everybody said that must have been a ghost. That must have been a ghost. So many ships went down. And there's 1,000 names at the seaport of drowned sailors. And you saw someone waiting for somebody to come home. I like to think he was waiting for his lover. I like to think he was gay. But that's just me. In any case, he was devastated about something. And so his very unhappy energy and my very unhappy energy, I'm foiled by life. This girl I like doesn't, you know, is with a boyfriend. I was in the same wavelength as him. And so that's why I saw him. I've seen one other ghost since, but that was definitely the most detail I've ever seen.
Hello, this is me, Simon. Did you know that during a past life regression, you can meet with your spirit guide? I conduct past life regression sessions over Zoom, and I've guided many clients to a spiritual encounter with their guide. If you would like to ask me how a session would work for you, you can book a free 20-minute consultation on my website, pastliveshypnosis.co.uk. The link is in the show notes. So it was some kind of thing of you matched emotional brain, I don't know, your mind state.
We're going to have to use that word that I don't know what it is. We were on the same vibration, the same frequency of great discontent.
And if you didn't feel like that, you wouldn't have seen him.
Maybe not. I don't know. We'll never know.
Before we started recording, you said something huge has happened recently. What was that?
Well, I had sort of toyed with the idea that when my mother died, I would move to somewhere else. And I started thinking maybe I'll move to the Oregon coast. And I didn't know where these ideas came from, but they just did. And then when I had my hip replaced in 2022, I got this message. I was coming out of the anesthetic. And I saw on the wall right in front of me, just above the window that goes to the nurse's station, I saw this beautiful display. By now, I'm very conversant with my angel. So he's just like, hey, I've got this visual for you. This is you at the center, and radiating out from you in all directions, sort of like a sun, are these sort of satellite circles. And they are all your friends and people that you love and people who connect with you. And he said, most of these are virtual. So you are going to Oregon. Don't be afraid. And you will still have these connections, but you cannot stay where you are. And he showed me an aerial view of me in my house. And I was like a line on what are those things called that you draw on when you're a little kid that makes a line? Anyway, I was just this little scribble, scribble, scribble all around my house. And he said, you are not useful. You need to go. So I began sort of obeying him, but then he'd make other things happen. A shooting happened on the other side of my fence. I got assaulted at the park. Someone drew a scythe on my dog, little Chihuahua type dog, a homeless man. And every time he would be like, go. You need to go. And so I eventually called a friend in AA, and he referred me to a friend of his, and I got connected to this house, and I went down to see it, and it had been out of my price range, but it had dropped. So while I was there, I got a couple messages. One was this friend of a trusted person who said he wanted to live in an outbuilding and fix it up. And I got the message. I was going to say, I'll charge you $300 a month rent plus $400 in work. And what came out of my mouth is, I'll charge you nothing, but I want $700. Anyway, that came out my mouth. And when they asked me for an offer, I made this ridiculous offer. I said, I'll have my house ready to sell in a month. It'll go on the market in a month. And in 3 weeks after that, it will be sold. So this was what they wrote up, pending. I had to list my market in a month. I mean, I had to list my house in a month, and I had to sell it. Anyway, I made these basically impossible terms. I don't know if you know what the housing market is like here, and I don't know if it's the same in UK as it is here, but it's just not happening. And somehow I got friends to come help me. I didn't have enough money, but I somehow got the house ready so that I left it at the very last time I could to catch a ferry to the place where I'm staying in the interim. And then it just looked like nobody's going to buy this house. Nobody's going to buy this house. 3 days before deadline, these people say, we want your house. So it ends up going on the market the day I said. And then, you know, the money coming through was just one day in time for closing. Everything happened one day ahead of when I would have lost the whole deal. And it closed yesterday, and I'm going down Saturday, and I'm starting my new life about, about 60 some days after I saw the house.
Wow.
Because he wanted it to happen. And I was talking to a friend who also had a near-death experience today. And we were talking about how there is no time for the spirits on the other side. So all they say is, this is going to happen. So that's why it doesn't happen to the last minute. But it happened. So my whole life is going to change now. My whole life, I'm going to move to a whole different place. And what I've asked him often, why do I have to go there? Why? What am I going to do? What am I going to do? And I have a dog that was severely beaten as a tiny puppy so that she didn't develop quite right. She can't see. She doesn't have teeth. Her ears are ginormous. And she looked at me while I was asking my angel this question. And through her eyes came the answer. You will help others the way you've helped me. And the spirits can talk through anyone, meant I'm going to A, have a sanctuary for animals, and B, invite recovering addicts once a year to come spend several days in the company of those animals to heal. And, you know, I speak a lot in AA. I might have conferences. I don't know exactly what he wants me to do, but I know he wants me to heal other people and animals with the love that is now like so powerful in my life.
With these different experiences that you have, that you talk about in the book, some of them came to you before you accepted the reality of your near-death experience. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if perhaps the spirit world were maybe targeting you, saying, like, we give her another experience. She'll get it eventually.
Well, the book is very clear. It has a genuine plot because I'm just saying no. No, no. And these experiences keep happening. And the big one is the one that got me sober. I drove home just raging drunk. I was so drunk. And I came to this place where the road narrowed. And I was at that point pretty suicidal. So I was not going to slow down from my 80 miles an hour. You got to see me smoking, drunk, blasting music, and driving at night. After people have taken my keys away and I have taken them back when they left me, driving through this place where the road narrows and just thinking, I don't care what happens. I got home, I got out of my car, I said, to myself, I'm kind of holding on to the car because I can't stand and I'm looking up at the starry night and I think I am such a badass when I drive drunk. And then boom, he hits me with this message that felt like lightning going through me from the stars, through me into the earth. And it said two things that gradually unpacked, but the two things were, this is the last time I can help you. And you do know right from wrong. And that was him just slapping me upside my head. He was just saying, fine, if you want to splatter your brains on a tree, if that's really what you want to do, you have free will, I'm not going to stop you anymore. But he also gave me to know that he had gotten me across that bridge. So in the morning, I had blacked out all except for the moment of crossing the bridge when he actually took the reins. And that's why spirit memories are, I mean, I know now that when spirit is with me, it's going to make an indelible memory. So I remember that. And I remember getting hit by the lightning, but I don't remember. When I woke up in the morning, I do know that I had made a huge mess with the oatmeal and leaving the milk out and just doing things that drunk people do. But that moment of crossing the bridge and that moment of receiving that shocking news is still crystal clear. And it took me a month, but I went to my first AA meeting January 29th, 1995, and I have not had a drink since. And not only being sober, but being led into AA and learning from the old timers in AA what I never learned from my parents about integrity, honesty, usefulness, giving love to others who don't look real good right now. And I have helped maybe 100 women get sober, and I don't know how many people I've helped by speaking. Sometimes people will come up to me and say, you said something at this speaker meeting, you know, in 2003, and it changed my life. And I don't know what these things are because I'm being led, but they got me on the right track then. And since 1995, it's just gotten better and better and better. And then once I started praying, I opened up an avenue for him to talk to me. And then once that was open, eventually it became possible to speak to my dead father and get interrupted by my dead boyfriend.
So he said to you, this is the last time I can help you, and you do know right from wrong. Mm-hmm. But then when you moved on and you became sober and you started doing these different things, they did come back and continue to help you. Wasn't there a time you were at the traffic lights and you heard a message that said, don't go?
Correct. Yeah, I think it's 99% Ignacio. That's what I call my angel. I don't know how many spirits I have, but he's the one that's got the direct line to my consciousness. So yeah, I was driving home, the light turned green and it was as clear. I mean, it's not words, but it was just felt to me almost like it was in the back seat, someone saying, don't go. And I looked and saw, you know, the light's green, that's ridiculous. But I looked in the rear view and there was no one behind me. So I was like, okay, wait, whatever, what do I have to do? I won't go. And so I stayed, and then 1 second, 2 seconds, and I just think, how long don't go? And that's when this car came racing down. It was silent, but it was going so fast. It came out from behind the other buildings and it was going 100 miles an hour, and it went right where I would have been if I had gone. So I said, thank you. That's the first time I talked back. That's the first time I answered. Now I talk to him all the time, and I whine and I complain and I ask and I do all of these things. And he's amused by me. When my father was dying, I got really excited that I might get to feel the light again the way I had felt it when my sister died. And so then I said to him, oh my God, I'm so awful here. My father's dying. And I'm like, oh goody, maybe I'll get to feel the light. And he cracks up. He laughed and he said, little one, you're human. That selfishness is built in. It's what you do and how you act that matters. Don't feel bad about what you think. And I crack him up a lot.
So is it all right if you tell us the story of what happened when your sister crossed over.
Yeah. So when my sister crossed over, it was 1997. I had only been sober 2 years, and I still did not know what to make of this voice that had zapped me that time. And I thought it might have to do with my near-death experience. I wasn't sure. I was just trying to fit pieces together in total ignorance, and no, there was no guidelines for society either. So I thought, what if that voice was somehow the same one that said, more real than anything back there? And they began to talk to me. I was sitting, my sister was dying from metastasized breast cancer, and it had spread to her bones, and they had very ill-advisedly given her a hip, what do you call it, hip replacement, because the cancer had rotted away her hip. So she could not survive that surgery. She'd also just, anyway, I was in the room. They had told us she had 2 weeks to live. We were spending the night, my brother and I, and it was just a little while before dawn, I would say, that the voice started saying, go tell her about the light. You need to tell her about the light she's going to cross. I felt these spirits. I didn't know what they were. I felt the light is what I called it to myself. I could feel the light seeping in through the window of her hospital room, kind of traveling over the floor like a fog, and then pooling over her body like just a million little stars. And I sort of understood that it was a million spirits, and they were generating, they were spinning, they were getting ready to cross her over. But something was the matter. She had said to my sister the night before, dying of cancer at 41 is the biggest diss God can give you. And she had said to me a few weeks before on the phone, when I'm out on the morphine, people think I can't hear anything. They think I'm not conscious, but I hear every word. And so what does my angel do? He gives me these two memories. He's like, do you see these pieces? This is what you need to do. You need to go and tell her about the light, because she can't cross because she's afraid. And so I was like, no, that's not real. That's not real. What is it? No, I'd open my eyes. I didn't see any light. I was just like, no, they said 2 weeks. She's not dying. She's not dying. And finally, he just wouldn't let up. So I said, okay, I'll do it, which is actually one of the bravest things I've ever done, given who I was at that time. So I got up and I went and I knelt by her bed and I said, close to her ear, she was Catholic. And so I said, Jesus will be with you. Jesus loves you. You'll be with him. It will be warm and so wonderful. And you will feel so much love and so much joy. And I tried to describe it to her. And then I got a message from him. That's good. It's done. It's done. So I went and I sat down. I did not perceive anything but my brother looking at me like, you got to be nuts. Clearly she's out. And what were you talking about? And 20 minutes later, she hemorrhaged and she died. And I forgot all about the voice. I just went into a panic. My brother and I both, there was blood coming out her nose. We ran around. We were saying, help us, help us, help us. And a doctor came and put a stethoscope on her and said, her heart is still beating, but it will stop when it runs out of oxygen. And dude, I just wanted to jump up from where I was sitting and grab that little doctor by her neck and throttle her and say, why aren't you saving my sister? That's what I really had this visceral, why? I understood that she needed to die, but I just could not take what she said. And all of a sudden, all that anger is gone and I am filled with love. I am filled with this glow of the light and the joy and all the stuff I had felt when I was in the sun. But now it's coming from my sister and I can feel her particular brand of love. If you know what I mean, every person has their own sort of flavor of love. And I felt hers, like I felt it, you know, certain Christmas mornings or certain times we were cooking Thanksgiving together, I felt her love. And she told me, I'm fine. I'm wonderful. I'm wonderful. I feel like she was with Jesus, man. She was. And she said, but there's something very important you need to do for me. I need you to go back and speak to my youngest, who is only 2, and I will tell you what to say when you get there. So I did go straight to her youngest, and I found him ignored by everyone, as she had known. Everybody's keening, and he's under the dining room table by himself, playing with a stormtrooper, speaking of Star Wars. And I told him, she told me to say, you know, your mama loves you more than anything. And all she really wanted to do was be your mom, but her body doesn't work now. And she couldn't stay in it. And she had to go, but she will always watch over you and love you. And he heard me. He heard me. I said, can I give you a hug? And he shook his head no. And he was just angry, but absorbing. And I have to say, he's a wonderful, wonderful young man today. And he does theater, and he's very involved in his church. And we recently climbed Mount Baker together, which is a 10,000-foot volcano here, because I still try to connect with him. In fact, my sister told me I was doing a bad job of being an aunt, and I need to do better. After she was dead, she told me recently. So I listen when they tell me, be a better aunt. I try to make it happen. So we arranged to do that climb together, and it was wonderful.
So your book's called Die Hard Atheist, from NDE Denier to Full On Woo Woo. And do you look back and you think, I'm so glad I've come on this path and come to where I am?
I am so blessed to be a woo woo. I am so lucky. I call it that. It's kind of tongue in cheek, because that's how I would have dismissed myself back in the day. But I feel that the angels have been so patient with me, and they have led me step by step aside, despite my dragging my feet horribly. And I don't know why I deserve this. I can only think because Ignacio has saved my life on other occasions as well. I can only think that I have the potential to help others, and that he sees that potential, and he wants me to maximize it. So he brought me out of my selfish, alcoholic, addicted darkness and showed me how to pass on what I have gotten to other people who are still trapped in that.
Yeah, I wonder if that's all planned out. I look back at my life and see where I am now. I wonder if things I've done in my 20s or 30s was just training to do what I'm doing now.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't be where you are without having had the experience of being an alcoholic.
Yeah.
It's like this was your destiny in a way.
Well, it's all about free will. I have interviewed other near-death experiencers who have actually been shown their lives as a big Plinko board kind of thing, with a jillion million little places where they reached a crossroad and made a decision. And some of them are, one guy that I interviewed, he was shown his future that way. Like, you could follow this route and you could, you know, train and become an airline pilot and that would be fine. Or you can choose this and it'll be death and you will start again. And he saw the whole thing, and he saw that these were all possibilities leading from where he was now, which was, you know, in a near dying state. And he said to God, I don't know why death is even in there. The only future I'm going to have is I'm going to get up from this rock and I'm going to go get help. And then he passed out on the sand aspirated and died more. But I like his image of this stretch in front of us of so many choices, and each one has bearing on where we end up, but they are free will. It's not destiny. It's free will.
Yeah, but it's been great talking to you. Thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Thanks so for having me. The book has a lot more in it, and I am told it's entertaining.
I read so much of it, and I got so many questions, but we don't give it all away because we want people to buy the book.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. No, it's definitely a story of how I got from the darkness to a place of light and happiness.
Yeah. So again, it's called Die Hard Atheist, From NDE Denier to Full-On Woo-Woo, Against My Will. And
do you like that cover? I painted that when I was very drunk.
Oh, it does look like some kind of modern art thing.
Yeah, no, that was when I was married and unhappy. And I was trying to say all of the restlessness. I tried to put all that into my back. But I feel it works as a cover because it's the face is sort of like the denier and the back is full of all this color that could represent these wonderful and terrible and all these spiritual experiences that I was having.
I'm just looking at it right now. So people can get that on Amazon and I'll put the link in the show notes.
Yes. Yes. And they can contact me. I'll give them an email address and they can contact me and it might take me a long time, but I will write back.
Great. Thank you. And thanks again for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Simon. It was lots of fun.
So this week I was talking to Louisa Peck about her book, Die Hard Atheist, From NDE Denier to Full-On Woo-Woo, Against My Will. And if you want to hear the rest of this amazing interview, you can sign up to Patreon. When you sign up for $6 a month, you get an extended episode every week. And for $3 a month, you get an extended episode every month. The Patreon episodes are ad-free and are released 2 days before the free versions. And please check out my other podcast. It's called the Alien UFO Podcast. And I release new episodes every Monday. And you can find it on almost every podcast app. I also have a tier in the Our Paranormal Afterlife Patreon campaign, where for $13.50 a month, you can get the Alien UFO Podcast extended episodes every week, as well as the Our Paranormal Afterlife extended episodes. And including the Alien UFO Podcast episodes, there are now much more than 100 extended episodes available in the back catalogue. And you can become a patron by going to patreon.com/ourparanormalafterlife or click on the Patreon button on my homepage at pastlifeshypnosis.co.uk. The links are in the show notes. And there is an Our Paranormal Afterlife Facebook group. If you'd like to join, you'd be very welcome. And if you enjoy the podcast, please leave a review. And be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.